Okay, more questions? Can I see a number of hands? I guess we'll take three questions and then we'll come back. So the lady over there, please.
Mark, it's Elaine Moore from Shared Lives Cymru. Thank you for being our Minister of Health. And at the risk of giving you even more work, I'd like to refer to a meeting earlier this week. Some of us in the room were there when David Marquand launched his Mammon's Kingdom book. Some mm-hmm. of your colleagues were in the room.
Yep.
Where he talked about the attrition of the public realm. And I think we in Wales are all too conscious of that and the need to restore both public institutions, but also the values that inspire them. And what I'm wondering is whether prudent healthcare is only a part of a bigger picture. I think it used to be called joined up government, one of the earlier strategies you prepared. And is this discussion being had broadly with other colleagues who are responsible for other public service deliveries? Because we talked, a number of people earlier today mentioned the need for this to be a people's service, a citizen service, and we recognise that health isn't only about the delivery of healthcare when you are sick, but quite rightly preventing that from happening, which is more than health. It's social services, it's education,
okay.
And all the rest.
Thank you. I think we got the point. I know there's a related question here.
Duncan McCombie from the Energy Saving Trust. Dr. Hopkins and Professor Phillips mentioned earlier prevention, as you've mentioned, Minister. It is recognised that cold and damp homes, especially our very poor housing stock in Wales, have a significant impact on health and admissions to hospitals. The trouble is, it sits across a number of ministerial portfolios. How are you as a minister going to make sure there is enough aspiration to break down the barriers across those ministerial portfolios to do things, for example, to stop people in cold, damp homes ending up in hospital?
Okay, and there's a final hand at the back there, I believe.
Robin Davis from the South East Wales Academic Health Science Partnership. It feels like we're flying a plane as well, a bunch of tyre. And you know, you mentioned Jane Head. What organisation do you think is best to mend that puncture? You know, we don't seem to be able to deliver on these strategies. Perhaps it's time for a new organisation that can do that.
We shouldn't talk ourselves into a belief that nothing has been achieved, or that, you know, all we have is SRGs have never got us anywhere. What the health service does today for people in 2014 is in some ways unimaginable in 2010 for some people. I went last week to see a former colleague of mine at the Assembly, Karen Sinclair. Some of you might remember her. She was a member of the original Assembly. She stood for three Assembly terms. She was a minister in the second Assembly, and in the third Assembly, she was taken catastrophically ill. Had she been taken ill a year before, the treatment that means that she is alive and well today simply would not have been available to her anywhere. It was experimental when she had the treatment 3 years ago, and it's not routine, but it is certainly, you know, mainstream type treatment today. So it's easy to talk ourselves into the belief that somehow, you know, the health service hasn't managed to do the things it wanted to do. Actually, it does a fantastic range of things, and more today than it's ever done before. But I'll pick up a couple of the other points. Elaine, just to start with yours. One of the fantastic things about the health service, and one of the reasons that it is so important to us, and important to us in Wales in a particular way, is that it's probably one of the last great democratic forums that we have. We live lives in which more and more people only rub shoulders with people who are like themselves. They live near people who are like themselves. They send their children to school with children who come from similar backgrounds. They may stand next to somebody in a football match or a rugby match from a different part of the social world, but the one place where you see everybody on an equal plane is when you go into a waiting room for an outpatient appointment in the Heath Hospital, and you'll be sitting next to people there who you'll never meet, probably, in the rest of your life. I had to go into the maternity ward in the Heath over a weekend, a couple of weekends ago, and I just so enjoyed the hour that I was there, because what I saw was people from every single part of the city, all of them in a shared experience that was enormously important to them, and doing it alongside people who, many ways, they may never come across much again. And that great sense that what the NHS is that it is part of the glue that still manages to hold together a society which in so many other ways is sharply unequal, is part of why it is so important to us. It is part of why we have to make sure that the sort of animating spirits of the health service are shared in other public services in Wales, and to a very large extent, that's what we have. Now, our critics on the other side of the bridge would describe the sort of model that we still aspire to in Wales as some sort of antediluvian way of thinking about things, you know, that we're simply stuck in the past, refusing to do all those modernising things that hold such fascination for others. But actually, to me, the fact that we still regard the National Health Service as primarily a public service in which the dividend of the public service ethos is what people who come through the door provide to the jobs that they do, is something that we would absolutely lose at our peril. We have to join that up with other services, and you know, it is one of the things about devolution that we ought to celebrate. I work on a corridor with many of the ministers who would have a shared interest in what decent housing conditions would bring for our population. I do not have to travel across Whitehall. I don't have to make special arrangements to see them. I'm able simply to walk 10 yards from my office and open the door and talk to people about shared things. We may not do it well enough, and it may not be quite so easy to translate those conversations into joined up activity on the ground. But we have an opportunity to do that through devolution that, you know, is the envy of many other places, I think.
Okay, further questions? Same remark, please.
Ed Bridges from Prostate Cancer UK. You talked about how one of the core principles of Britain Health is about not doing things that do no good. And I think we all, you know, agree to the kind of ambition and principle behind that. But of course, where does that leave those patients who are terminally ill within that debate? Alison Williams talked earlier about terminally ill cancer patients who the decision might be over a treatment that won't save their life, because you can't save their life, but it might postpone the point of death by, you know, 6 weeks, and gives them 6 weeks longer with their children or their grandchildren. Where do those people sit within the Britain healthcare debate? And as a minister, how do you expect those balanced judgments to be arrived at?
Two hands here, so the lady first, please.
Mark Donnelly from the University of South Wales. We've heard today every speaker has spoken about austerity. It's a real present danger threatening to affect all of our public services. But in the course of the debate today, we have coupled together prudent healthcare and saving money. And I started to feel very uncomfortable about that, because as I think, I can think of ways of saving you money, and if we can have a discussion about that in all kinds of ways that we can reduce the cost base with the NHS. But I think we also need to decouple it, because at its core and at its essence, it's about better outcomes for patients. And I think we're in danger of creating a narrative, because we don't disambiguate the two, that it's entirely about reducing the cost base because of the austerity that we're facing.
Yeah.
Okay. 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 Gentleman here.
Thank you. Peter Evans, Transition Town, Chepstow. As you know, Chepstow is at a very sharp edge. In fact, I live 1 mile from the border of Offa's Dyke, and there's been a great deal of adverse publicity recently about the comparative values and waiting time and the whole rest of it. I've just finished reading NHS SOS, an edited book by Raymond Tallis about the state of the NHS in England. It has two mentions in Wales, where it actually, if not an exemplar, he comes in and mentions the credit of Wales. And this is something which I think you have to address, because all I hear is the demoralisation of services in Wales for the people who work there by the loss of expectation and lack of belief in the NHS in Wales, particularly on the borderland. And I feel, you know, this politically isn't being effectively challenged, as Raymond Tallis seems to be doing in his book. And the impression has been given that the NHS England is going from strength to strength, and things are rosy, the waiting lists are down, when in fact familiarisation with the financial situation has been various indications that it's collapsing. Yet, you know, this thing doesn't seem to be mentioned very much at all. So I think there's a great deal of work to be done in terms of perception of what you mentioned is the public spirited aspect and the democratic nature of the NHS in Wales, which doesn't seem to come over very much in the public debate.
Is there a final question? You probably won't have a chance to come back to the audience one more time. Jeremy.
Jeremy Phelps, Fiverr. One thing that strikes me about all this is, and some of the principles, is that the agenda item that was really important a year or so ago about innovation and different thinking and so on seems to have been lost. And one of my concerns as somebody who works in the pharmaceutical industry is that our industry thrives on innovation, on inventing new medicines, and then being able to make sure that patients get them. So one concern, I guess, is that when we're looking at interventions in the NHS that are evidence, medicines have more evidence than virtually anything else. I think there'd be very people who would argue with that. And yet there is a concern that this approach might end up restricting the NHS's ability to be innovative in terms of its new medicine.
Okay. Would you like to start?
Yes, indeed. I don't think prudent healthcare drives out innovation. I think it's exactly the opposite. I think its challenges is that it requires innovation on such a scale that it's, you know, you can end up feeling challenged about our ability to create innovation in that way. It does mean, I think, that we have to be less mesmerized by the new and more willing to focus on things that we know are effective. The Chief Medical Officer is sitting there. She reminds me regularly when I meet her that process innovation is more important than product innovation in the NHS, and yet the NHS is mesmerised by product innovation and finds process innovation rather dull and boring, and yet process innovation can benefit huge numbers of patients if we do it properly. And we don't have time this afternoon for me to talk to you about a practical example of lymphedema services in Wales, which have been just radically improved in recent years by a group of nurses who took a service which was really not doing a good job for patients at all, have process innovated to make it just run in a new way. It treats more patients, it treats them more quickly, it treats them more effectively. As it happens, it does it at lower cost, but that's a byproduct, not the intention of the thing. And it meets every prudent healthcare principle you can imagine, and it's innovative in its core. So Donna's point, I think, is a really, really important one. If we find prudent healthcare being dragged into a debate that's really just about cost savings, then we've lost what prudent healthcare is about. Because what prudent healthcare is about, it is about providing better outcomes for patients within the resource that we have got. It is about using what we have got in a better way, in an equity-driven way, as I said, so that outcomes for patients are better. I wanted a chance just to come back to a small theme which I didn't have a chance to mention earlier, but is very important to me in the prudent healthcare world, and it'll be very close to things that Donna is involved in, which is what the Americans call the only do what only you can do principle. Here's my characterization of it, that the way that the health service, not just in Wales but elsewhere, works is it works as an escalator. It's constantly passing people up the hierarchical ladder so that you end up, you know, seeing the person at the top. Actually, no consultant should ever be routinely seeing people who could just as clinically, effectively and competently be being seen by somebody else. So prudent healthcare is about liberating the pool of talent that we have amongst the wider range of professions who are involved in the NHS and making sure that we take full advantage of the contribution that they are able to make. You probably heard it already in relation to the ambulance service and what paramedics are able to do. You will certainly have heard it in relation to orthodontics. No orthodontic consultant should be seeing children other than those who have a really serious need to be seen by a consultant. We have to free up their time by allowing dentists in primary care to do more of the orthodontic range, and we have to free up the time of dentists to do that by using a new cadre of dental therapists who are able to do a great deal of the routine end of dentistry in a perfectly clinically appropriate and qualified way. It means dragging people down the hierarchy of the professions rather than accelerating them up it, and nurses and others are absolutely key to that. I wish I had an answer to how we managed to, you know, get a better grip on the narrative that is presented to people who rely on newspapers and broadcast media for their account of the Welsh NHS. It's incredibly difficult. For what it's worth, my own belief about what is going on at the London media end is that amongst the right-wing press, and Britain is the most right-wing press in the Western world, it's all about preparing the ground so that if the Tories are elected again next year, they will move in England from covert privatisation, which is going on all the time now. 70% of new contracts being let by clinical commissioning groups are going to the private sector, to overt privatisation. And they will do it because the public will have been softened up by that sort of cascade of stories that will allow them to say, well, it was all rubbish anyway, wasn't it? Haven't you been listening to the news? Haven't you been reading the papers? Haven't you been seeing that the NHS was a busted model in any case? Well, we will not be doing that here in Wales. And if there's a Talis book in another 5 years against that sort of background, then the fact that we will have managed to preserve a national service, a planned service, a service that has health as well as illness as part of its ambition, that's provided by people whose motivation is public service rather than the extraction of private profit, then we will stand out even more as a beacon of what the NHS was meant to be than we do today. I'd like to return to Ed's point, because I think he puts his finger on a really difficult dilemma and a set of decisions that are already, you know, those will not be new decisions because they're there today, aren't they? You know, I took a decision last year, and I took it after a lot of thought and not without a lot of hesitation, to sign a piece of paper that provides treatment for 13 people in Wales at the cost of more than £1 million. And when I think of what I could do with that money, and you know, the urgent needs that there are in all sorts of ways, and the many, many more people who might have got treatment that would have made a big difference to them more quickly if we'd used the £1 million or more in a different way, that's not a trivial dilemma at all. But in the end, I was persuaded, I guess, that the difference that that treatment made in the lives of that very small number of people was so dramatic in their circumstances that those arguments outweighed the others. Now, your question, Ed, was, I think, how do we make those decisions in the future? And my belief about it is that the co-production principle that we've talked a little bit about, but not actually explicitly, is a big help to us in doing that, because those decisions have to be, I think, more powerfully informed by lay opinion. That we have to bring not just clinicians and those people who have a very direct and, not to use the word in a pejorative way, partisan voice to contribute to that decision, you know, the campaigning groups and the individuals directly affected. But we have to, in a citizen's jury type sort of way, bring in lay opinion to help us to make some of those really hard-edged decisions where we've got one sum of money and a lot more than one call on it, and a decision has to be made as to how to distribute it. Bringing people around the table to do it with us, I think, will improve the decisions that we make, just as in Sharon's example, and I think she was drawing on some very powerful work done by the King's Fund in recent times that shows that if patients are involved in decisions about their treatment, if they're given information about it and the consequences of different courses of action are explained to them, and they are given an opportunity to go away and think about those choices in their own lives, when they come back with a decision, it is absolutely not axiomatic that they head for the most expensive, most intrusive forms of treatment. Actually, what people do in very large numbers is to say, I've decided not to have that course of treatment, which was the most expensive and the most, because for me, in my set of circumstances, I'll take a bargain. That means I'll take this set of outcomes for those sort of interventions because they will suit me better. It's one of the sort of more cheerful things about it, that you'll never make progress in the sort of preventative agenda if you think it's a scolding agenda and a lecturing agenda and a, you know, telling people what they've got to do agenda. But if it's an explanatory agenda and it's bringing people around the table to think things through with you agenda, then people make the right decisions far more than they make the wrong ones.
So finally, it's been a fascinating afternoon, but this needs to be action-focused. One of the questions that the Bevan Commission have asked us to put to the people here today is, what are they going to do on their organisations as a result of today to develop this agenda? What's your challenge, what's your plea to the people here?
I think my challenge and my plea a bit is this. Look, we're still at the stage in Wales about debating prudent healthcare principles. When I was teaching would-be social workers, we used to talk about a process that people go through in which, you know, they go from storming to norming to performing. So we're still at the storming stage here. We're still debating. We're still, you know, trying to sort of make sure that we've got an agreed set of ideas between us. And over time, that will settle down into a set of new norms for the way we do things. And then we'll have to perform against them. But at the moment, we're about debating. So first of all, it's about people taking part in the debate, contributing their own ideas, helping us to shape some of these things. And then it's moving into the more intensely practical stuff, and probably the more difficult and challenging stuff of saying, if we've got principles of, you know, minimum harm avoidance, minimum intervention, a workforce in which you only do what only you can do. If co-production is to mean something that is not just a set of cosy, oh, we'll chat together, but some hard-edged conversations with people, how do we apply those ideas in the services that we provide? There are some really good practical examples already of how this can be done. We're borrowing heavily from Canada, who've done more of the thinking than we have, and some of the ways that they are doing it. We hope to have the head of the Canadian Choosing Wisely Canada movement, which is a movement of Royal Colleges and medical academics in Canada, to lead this over in Wales in the autumn. And then we've just got to, you know, in the jobs that we do, think of ways in which we can apply a set of agreed and common principles to change the way that things happen.
Mark Trickford, thank you very much.